Hi, and welcome to the Newbery Chronicles. This is a podcast where two people read through every Newbery Medal winning book, and then we talk about it. My name is Michael.
And I'm Rebecca.
And this time, we're talking about the 1979 medal winner, The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin. And I'm stumbling a little bit over this because I'm out of practice. We've not podcasted in 2 months, and I apologize to our faithful listeners. That's been so long. I know your life's just not been complete without listening to us ramble about a children's book from decades ago. Anyway, Rebecca, you looked like you're about to say something.
Michael was waiting for me to apologize, but I've decided I've apologized enough on this podcast.
I was not waiting. You looked like you were going to say something. But we're out of practice, so this is why we have awkward pauses.
Yes.
Anyway, so we'll be talking about the Westing Game. However, before that, don't forget you can email us at newberrychronicles@gmail.com if you so choose to leave us feedback. And before we talk about the Westing Game, we'll talk about what we've read in the intervening months, the chasm of time between our last podcast.
Okay.
Go for it, Rebecca. You've read a lot.
Actually. I have, and I'm just going to, like, give one-word reviews where I can.
Really?
No, I'm not good at that.
That would be fun.
But I read the eighth Louise Penny novel, The Beautiful Mystery, and I'm just going to say disappointing. I read James by Percival Everett, which I probably talked about on the last podcast.
Hard to know because it was so long ago.
What I will say is that book is a masterpiece, an utter masterpiece.
That's more than one word.
Well, it deserves more than one word. Louise, I love you, but that book did not deserve more than one word.
Hmm.
Anyway, James is a modern retelling of Huckleberry Finn, from Jim's perspective, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about this book because we do not have the time, but this book deserves a whole review. So this is one that at the end of the year or the beginning of next year, when we do our special podcast where we talk about like other books beyond Newbery's that we read, I want to spend a lot of time on this one. This book is very worthwhile, has very incredible commentary about race relations through this story that is like well loved by a lot of people. I will say it doesn't have like a lot of hijinks like Huck Finn does, but it is truly very wonderful. And I will say there is a sexual assault that was kind of hard for me to read, so I just do want to put that trigger warning on in case anybody takes our recommendations to heart. But very, very good. I read Tact and State of Wonder, two novels by Ann Patchett, and I have one novel left of Ann Patchett's, and I am pretty sure I have read her whole bibliography. Well, no, she wrote this book about Nashville that I don't really need to read. But anyway, Tact, set in Memphis, pretty cool. State of Wonder, very good. Set in the Amazon rainforest.
That's oh, wow. More than one word. Two very different settings.
Yes, they are two very different settings. And I'm very intrigued by what her inspiration for State of Wonder was. It was good. It was one of her earlier ones, I'm pretty sure. The Waves by Virginia Woolf. We've already talked about that one quite a lot on this podcast because we were reading that for a long time.
But we finished it.
Also my fault.
That wasn't your fault. We were reading that as
we
a
We were
group.
Reading it slowly. It's a book to be sipped.
That's right.
And it's wonderful. I really liked it. Michael and I liked it more than our friend. But we all had riveting conversation about it. Read it with your friends. It's good. I read Woven. The subtitle of that is Nurturing a Faith Your Kids Don't Have to Heal From by Meredith Miller. For those of you that don't know, I am a children's pastor. This was the best spiritual book I've read in a very long time. It was very, I don't know, Meredith Miller is very wise, has a lot of beautiful things to say about faith, and also, like, takes into consideration that people are coming from different perspectives, different backgrounds, and there are ways that we can approach faith differently with our kids, and ways that I found very healing for me as a person, also very inspirational for life as a mother and life as a pastor. If you are a person of faith that's wondering, I don't know what to give my kids, I highly recommend this book. It's very good. I read The Poet X by Elizabeth Acevedo. It is a YA novel about an Afro-Latina youth named Xiomara Batista. Her mother is super religious, and she is not. She has a lot of questions about faith. She very much feels like a disappointment to her mother, and poetry is a safe haven for her. So this book is written in poetry form. I listened to it, which I would not recommend. I wish I would have read it in a hard copy, because I think you would have been able to see more that these are poems, that she's telling her story in a poem. Has a lot to say about like mother-daughter relationships and just like navigating religion as a young adult and really just change with different cultures and navigating like code switching. I thought it was very, very good. I read two Kate DiCamillo books.
We got a whole email about this and you still messed it up.
I read The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane, which is a very odd book, you guys. It was very weird. I liked it. It's about this China rabbit, not like a rabbit from China, but like a China doll rabbit.
Okay.
And he is anthropomorphized, and the story is told from his perspective and the different journeys he makes and different owners he has. It was not her best, in my opinion, but like her brain is so interesting. Anyway, I also read The Beatrice Prophecy by her, also not my fave, but it does have some really interesting commentary just about how we interpret and determine future and how people in power determine that. Really, it deals a lot with, like, prophecies in, like, medieval period, so not really, like, our current day, but really does make the argument about we as humans are the ones that are rendering fate to our will, and it's not really all these other forces at play. Anyway, it was good, but not my favorite. And then I read The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes by Suzanne Collins, which is the first Hunger Games prequel. That's really Snow's origin story. And this is not she has more to tell. Like, I could tell at the end of this, it was like, oh, there's going to be a sequel to this prequel. Which, I don't know. I read this because it was like, okay, I'll probably get into the story. I enjoyed The Hunger Games okay. This book was too long for, like, the information that I got about Snow. It seemed to be, like, his character seemed to change really suddenly to me at the end, in a way that was dissatisfying considering how long this book was and considering that there's going to be more. So, anyway, that's all I have to say about the books that I read. I did that pretty quickly.
You did, for as many books as you have. I have fewer books. I don't know if I'll have more to say about them.
Probably more to say.
Maybe I will. I just like to talk. So in terms of books that I've finished, so I'm a high school teacher, you guys may know, because I've mentioned it before, and teaching seniors this year, and one of the things in our curriculum is to teach Pygmalion, which is the play by George Bernard Shaw, which was later adapted into My Fair Lady and other things, Pretty Woman. I had not read this play in quite some time, so I reread it, and it's a great time. It's a good play. I like George Bernard Shaw. I like Pygmalion. My students, for the most part, seem to enjoy Pygmalion, which was not a foregone conclusion in my mind. It is a good play. They're still elitist about language. They'll talk down at people who they think talk weird, which is contrary to the spirit of the play, I feel like. But, you know, there's a little Henry Higgins in all of us. So that was a pretty quick, fun read. Another quick, fun read was this book called How To, which my brother Daniel gave me for my birthday. And if you've ever read the webcomic XKCD, which is, like, as far as webcomics go, like, pretty famous, It's by the same author, so Randall Monroe, and basically the concept of this book is taken from like something that he's kind of done as a side project on the XKCD website, which is to, through like kind of humorous comics and explanations, give how-to guides for kind of very ordinary things, but doing it in very absurd ways. So like, for instance, one of the chapters in here is called How to Move. You know, he talks about, well, you could get a moving truck and pack up all your stuff and leave, or what if you wanted to move your house with you? And here's all the stuff you could do with that, you know, and eventually he gets to the part of, like, attaching balloons and rockets to your house and trying to, like, move your house that way. And so all these things kind of escalate from, like, really simple, like, how-tos to, like, but what if we did this and what if we did this? And it's in some ways like a follow-up to a book that he also wrote called What If?, which is kind of like taking absurd questions and like kind of pushing them like through like their, you know, using science and like kind of, you know, an actual understanding of physics to do these absurd questions. Like, what if the Earth suddenly stops spinning or that sort of thing? And this book is almost the opposite approach, which is to take these really normal things that we all kind of know how to do and using, you know, his knowledge of like engineering and physics to take that to absurd degrees. So that was fun. Less fun, but and less quick of a read, but also good, was this book I read called Reign of Terror by Spencer Ackerman. Spencer Ackerman is like a journalist, and he's worked with like The Guardian and people like that. And a lot of what he's done has been like a war reporter, not like a war correspondent necessarily, but like reporting on like the all the kind of infrastructure of like the wars of the 21st century, particularly like the American like war on terror, which is what this book is about. And so this book's kind of like a history of the war on terror, which some of it was really familiar to me because I lived through it. Some of it was less familiar to me because, you know, once you get into like the Obama years and stuff like that, it's not...
Well, also because you were a child.
Well, yeah, but honestly, the stuff that happened when I was a child, I'm much more aware of now, because that's the stuff everyone talks about, like 9/11, right. Invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan and those sorts of things. They talk a lot less about, like, you know, what the United States was doing in Afghanistan during the Obama administration when, you know, very complicated and consequential things were happening, but was not, like, as headline-grabbing at the time. So it is a history of the war on terror, but a history through the particular lens of how the war on terror kind of helped to institutionalize the kind of mechanisms that allow for kind of right-wing authoritarianism to be taking over the United States like it is right now. So the subtitle of the book is How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. And basically, it does a pretty good job of showing how there's continuity both of, like, personnel in the federal government as well as just ideas that kind of, they don't all start in the, you know, 9/11, post-9/11, you know, reaction to, terrorism, but, you know, they get kind of really juiced in that era, and a lot of those, like, carry over into, like, things that we would see, like, that helped create Donald Trump's presidency and some of the stuff Donald Trump tried to do as a president. And, you know, to be honest, like, some of the stuff like Barack Obama and Joe Biden have also done as presidents as well. This is not, like, this, like, distant, subjective take on, you know, the war on terror. I mean, Spencer Ackerman is, like, you know, palpably furious at what the federal government has done. You know, there's a lot of, you know, real... kind of the way he writes is, you know, there's a lot of righteous anger against, who he sees as kind of like the bureau, you know, the kind of convergence of these kind of like technocratic Democrats and like these, neocons that were in the Bush administration, and how it basically was an alliance where both Democrats and Republicans were kind of agreed on the fact that we got to go hunt down the terrorists, and how this created this, you know, kind of monstrosity of, like, not just you know, domestically, although it did, you know, with surveillance and, like, changing the tenor of, like, racial attitudes in America and that sort of thing, but also, like, obviously catastrophic events overseas in, you know, countries like Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. You know, so it is definitely from the lens of, like, someone who is, like, firmly anti-war, firmly anti-specifically the war on terror. But, like, to be honest, I think that's a fair response, you know. It's, you know, this kind of forever war has been going on for so long and has yielded very little fruits. We've accomplished almost zero of the objectives that we entered this, you know, ethos, you know, hoping to accomplish. And I don't know, I found it fair, and I thought it was insightful how it pointed out the ways that there's connections between all the separate political administrations. And then currently, this is the last thing I'm going to talk about. I'm not done with this yet, but Rebecca is waving her hands in celebration. I'm reading a Ann Patchett novel, Bel Canto, which is, I guess, like her most famous book. Yes. And about two-thirds of the way through, I'm enjoying it. It's good. It's funny at times. It's just interesting how, like, this kind of, like, community has formed within, like, a hostage situation, basically. I will say that the thing that I'm waiting to happen, and maybe it will happen, maybe it won't, but, like, I don't think that the guerrilla radicals who have taken over and created this hostage situation, I don't feel like I know enough about them. And that kind of feels like the hole in the book right now, is that we get these kind of, not elaborate backstories, but we get, long passages where we have different hostages, their perspectives on things, and they're thinking back to their lives previous to this and how they ended up here. And it seems like we get little glimpses where maybe for a paragraph or two, we'll jump into the mind of one of the generals who's, you know, kind of in charge of the hostage situation. But it, you know, and the little glimpses we get are really intriguing, you know, about, like, the political kind of oppression that they've experienced, about how many people they know who are in jail for, you know, criticizing the president and things like that. You know, we get little glimpses of that, like, kind of indicate why they would want to do something like this. You know, why are radical politics interesting to them and appealing to them? But we've not gotten nearly the insight on them. And so yeah. I'm hoping the end of the book will fill in some of that, but maybe it won't. Even if it doesn't, I'll still have enjoyed the book.
I'm glad. Let me tell you one interesting fact about that before we get on to, that book was published in 2001. Speaking of the Reign of Terror.
I noticed. Yeah. It's
interesting. And
prior to 9/11, actually, I believe.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Because I looked this up, I was like, did we really have book about, like,
she was writing that book before 9/11.
Yeah.
Speaking of Bel Canto, one final thing. Anne is, you like how I talk about her, like, we're friends. Anyway, she's coming out with an anniversary edition of this book on November 5th that is annotated with her handwritten notes.
Ooh.
And have I already pre-ordered it as a gift for myself for my birthday? I most certainly have. So, anyway.
Happy birthday, Rebecca. well, on that note, let's jump over to the Westing game.
Yes.
I believe I am talking about the author, right? Ellen Raskin, who is interesting as a person, but not, like, you know, she doesn't lead a life of crime or something. Some of these people are, like, surprisingly, like, wow, they had whole lives outside of what we know here. And she didn't really. She was mostly in the arts her whole career, but there are some interesting connections to stuff. So she's born in Milwaukee in 1928. I found this quote so she went to the University of Milwaukee, and there's a defunct page on the University of Milwaukee's website where they talk about famous alumni. I had to go into, like, the, you know, Wayback Machine to get this page. So you're welcome for my internet sleuthing. But on that page, she was quoted as having said about her childhood, quote, "I had straight dark hair, tap danced with two left feet, had a singing range of three wrong notes, spilled ink on my best dress, and lost my piano to a finance company."
Oh.
So that's how she described her childhood. But anyway, she goes to University of Wisconsin originally to study journalism, but then she goes to a trip to Chicago and goes to the Art Institute of Chicago and is so moved by the art that she decides, I'm going to study the fine arts instead of journalism. So she becomes a graphic artist, and apparently had quite a prolific career as a graphic artist. She illustrated for the Saturday Evening Post. She illustrated for pharmaceutical journals. She also made illustrations for people's books and dust jackets. She apparently made over 1,000 book jackets, and probably the most famous one is she made the first edition dust jacket for A Wrinkle in Time.
Very cool.
But she...
Which was our second podcast episode, if you'd like to hear what we have to say about that book.
Go back to episode... I remember how we numbered it. Did we have a... Is it episode 2, I guess?
I guess so.
Because we have the introductory episode.
Yeah.
Whatever the case, you know, Newbery connections abound. So anyway, eventually in the 1960s, she started deciding, hey, I can write my own children's books. So she started writing children's picture books that she illustrated herself. And the first one came out in 1966. It's called Nothing Ever Happens on My Block. Somewhere in here, she moved to Greenwich Village in New York City. Which is where she lived till she died. And one of her books is set in the house that she lived in, like a duplex in Greenwich Village. And one of her books is set there in the house that she lived in. She eventually wrote 12 children's picture books and 4 children's novels. So The Westing Game was the last one that she wrote, which she published in 1978 and then won the medal in 1979. But apparently also relevant to the Westing Game, she was really into stock trading and had a stock portfolio. Her husband called her a finance capitalist, which I guess makes sense with what happens in the Westing Game. You know, I may have wished that she had a different hobby than to participate in the stock market, but you never know. Maybe she was, you know, trading stocks in an ethical way. Whatever the case, she died in 1984, fairly young. She had a, had complications with some illness, I believe.
Connective tissue disease.
Connective tissue disease. I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, she was 56.
56.
Also, she grew up in the Great Depression.
Yeah. That's probably why her piano was taken by a finance company. Yeah. Imagine growing up in the Great Depression, your
and
piano is repossessed, and you invest in the stock market. I guess it's not exactly the same thing, but...
Maybe it was, like, what was her downfall she determined it never would be again. I don't know. Master the thing that destroyed you.
That's true. Speaking of mastering a thing that destroyed you, you're going to have to explain the plot of The Westing Game to me again, because I read this quite a long time ago, and I need to be reminded of some of the details.
Okay, so
let's talk about The Westing Game.
I'm going to do my best. There's a lot that goes on in this book, like a lot of subplots and stuff that's not going to be helpful for me to describe, but I am going to tell you what happens in this book. You guys are pretty familiar that we give spoiler alerts to the book we're talking about, so...
This is a mystery, so, like, the spoiler is the solution.
I would not listen to this episode if you either have not read this book and are interested in reading it. I wouldn't listen to this. Anyway, this is a mystery murder novel of sorts. This novel is about a wealthy businessman who's named Sam Westing. He dies. At the reading of his will, it's revealed that his named heirs are all tenants of the adjacent Sunset Towers apartment building. The will states that one of his heirs took Westing's life, and the will is structured like a puzzle, with the 16 heirs paired off and challenged to find the solution. The pair that solves the mystery inherits Westing's entire $200 million fortune, which are just pennies today.
Yeah, I mean, I got that in my back pocket.
And then they can control his paper company as well. And I decided this sounds like something Michael Scott would do at his funeral. Now that I'm talking about it, who would inherit Scranton Paper Company, or whoever it is?
There's no way Michael Scott ends his career with $200 million.
No, what is the name of the company?
The Michael Scott Paper Company.
No. Yes, that
Dunder
was his.
Dunder Mifflin?
Dunder Mifflin.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Anyway, moving on. I don't know the best way to summarize this, because there are, like I said, 60 heirs who are all connected to Westing in some way. I don't think it's helpful for me to explain to you who all of them are, but as we go along, we can tell you. This entire game, this entire book is kind of like a big game of Clue, except that no murder has actually happened.
Dun, dun, dun.
Westing has given each pair a different set of clues and tells them that what is missing is really what matters. The clues seem like these nonsense words at first, but when they all collaborate, they realize that it makes up the words of the song America the Beautiful, except that it's missing the words that, when put together, spell Bertha Erica Crow. Now, Crow is one of the heirs, and she is also Westing's ex-wife. So the motive for this alleged murder is that... I don't guess this is motive, but this is interesting. Supposedly, Crow murdered Westing, and Crow previously pressured hers and Westing's daughter to marry a politician who was not a good guy. This led to their daughter dying by suicide. So, the idea is that Westing is, like, trying to get revenge on his ex-wife by framing her for his murder. Anyway, she turns herself in but she's like, well, this is the answer to the puzzle, so give my inheritance to Angela, who's another one of the heirs, which we'll talk about that in a minute. Anyway, she confesses this crime she didn't commit. She's arrested. She's later released. Around this whole time, Sandy McSouthers, who is the doorman of Sunset Towers and is also one of the heirs, dies mysteriously and very suddenly. Turtle Wexler, who is the young...
Someone who's listening to this who hasn't read this book is going to be just baffled.
Sorry, I'm probably not doing a good job.
No, you're doing a great job. It's just really difficult to summarize this book.
We're almost done, you guys. You're almost there, okay? So Turtle Wexler, who is the youngest of the heirs, is she like 12?
Something thereabouts. Like, she's a child
pre-teen,
for sure.
Preteen, most certainly. This girl is smart, though.
She trades stocks.
She does. She begins to put together that Barney Northrop, who I've not mentioned yet, but he was the man who originally showed all these heirs their apartments. She realizes that Barney Northrop, Sam Westing, and Sandy McSouthers are all the same man. And she realizes that with the names Northrop, Westing, and McSouthers, that what is missing is East. She reads a clue from his will that leads her to find Westing by his new name, Mr. Julian Eastman. Turtle inherits the money.
So he's faked his death, basically.
He's faked his death twice.
Twice.
Anyway, Turtle inherits the money, but she doesn't reveal the secret to anyone. And the final pages of the book are just revealing the lives of everyone as they grow up. How's that for a summary?
Pretty good. This book is not that long. It's like 170 pages or something like that, but it is dense.
Packed.
Like it is
packed.
If I had tried to read this as a child, like a younger child, you know, I would have been a little bit lost.
But don't you think like 4th, 5th, 6th grade, we would have loved this book?
Yeah, like
it
would have made me feel smart, especially cuz the child solves the mystery.
What did you like about this book?
Well, I did like how complex it was.
Mm-hmm.
I like, you know, any mystery novel, you're going to have your, like, colorful characters. And this has, like, a ton of colorful characters,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, some of these characters are more developed than others, but they all have, like, little personality quirks. The fact that they're all sharing a building together is very fun and interesting because they're interacting not just, you know, over this mystery, but they also have to live next to each other, like... One of them owns a restaurant, another owns a coffee shop, and it's all in the building. It's like these people never leave this building, apparently.
Doug does to go run his track race.
Yeah.
And Otis Amber.
Doug is a teenager who's like a jock, like superstar athlete at the local high school.
And Otis and Crow go to the soup kitchen.
That's true. So it's not literally that they never leave, but right. we rarely see them outside of
this building. Most of the activity of this book takes place either in Sunset Towers or in the Westing Mansion.
Right. Which the kids sneak into at the beginning, which is kind of fun. Anyway, yeah. I just think it's fun that it's like mostly a single location and that the building is like this ecosystem that kind of, the ecosystem shifts depending on like the alliances that are formed in like the solving of this puzzle and all that. And so like, there's also like bombs that go off in this tower, Sunset Tower, and that obviously affects things. So they close down a restaurant, and anyway, the environment and the way that people interact in the environment, I thought was very fun, and very interesting, and like I mentioned, a short book, but like packing all this, you know, in a really economical way. That I thought was pretty impressive, especially while still making it like a children's book. Mm-hmm. You know, and to be honest, like I don't know that many like murder mystery books that are for children. Like this is a fairly untapped
mm-hmm.
genre. Like,
well, and then you kind of find out it's not actually a murder mystery.
Right, but it's like structured as such, right. you know. Right. And I don't know. I think that's just like kind of an interesting project to take like the normal complexities and you know tropes of like a mystery novel and making them accessible to a younger audience without actually taking away that much of the complexity. You know, like this is a, like we've talked about, a really complex narrative with a lot of interlocking pieces and a lot of stuff that's like subtext and that sort of thing, and I feel like you could have written this a different way and it would have been for adults, but you wouldn't have had to change the plot or the characters that much. And so I just think that that's cool and impressive that she was able to do that. I've not read any of her other books, but I'm curious like how those are as well. Just because this is such an interesting little experiment, and it's, I don't know, we've not really read any books, you know, like this or attempting something like this throughout this podcast. What did you like about it, Rebecca?
I liked all those things. This book was very fun. It was very clever. It did not take me a long time because it was not interesting. Life has just been kind of chaotic lately. I wish I would have read it quicker, but that's just because I wouldn't have forgotten all these little pieces as you go on. I think this is one that's designed to read like in a few settings. Like I think that's best how it's to be consumed. It's a really great puzzle. I was skimming it again today to like put the pieces together. But anyway, and you find all these things as you go along that hint at the ending. So I would like to reread it because I would have never picked up on them if I didn't know the ending. But she just does such a really good job with the story. And, like, she gives you little pieces as you go along that if you're reading it closely or you know what's going to happen, you can see that and be like, oh, that's really clever how you did that. So I thought it was really, really good. I am just so surprised neither of us had ever heard of this book.
No, but there's like a whole, like, there was a movie that came out.
Yeah.
Apparently HBO has optioned it for a series or something.
Right. And it's, like, so good. Your dad would love this. Like, we need to tell him.
Yeah, if he hasn't already read it.
But I don't know how this book was never on our radar, like, or why people haven't talked about this one. But it's, like, it's just fun. Like, it's really fun. It's really clever. It is, like, I mean, I loved, not that this is at all the same thing, but I loved those books like Encyclopedia Brown when I was little and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And I would have loved this. I just don't know
how we got here of it. I mean, it's not the same in the sense of like you flip through the back to see the solution, but like
right.
it kind of has the same appeal in the sense of like with Turtle, that character, like that you have this kind of precocious kid who's getting into, you know, adult affairs and is able to kind of see through the things that like the adults' prejudices don't allow them to see.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the kid who ends up solving the mystery. And she's a little capitalist, which is kind of like Encyclopedia Brown as well.
Yeah. Like it's just, it's very, you know, you already said this, but yeah, like I would just echo, it's very colorful, but like in just a very creative way. Like It's just really well done. In the foreword, her friend says that until she wrote this book, Raskin was considered more of an illustrator, not an author, even though she had written the text of some like picture books. So I think, I don't know who Jenny is. Maybe it's her daughter, but Ellen Raskin dedicated this book to Jenny, who asked for a puzzle mystery. So it's just really cool that somebody asked her for that, and she just wrote this epic book. Anyway, what did you dislike?
Well, so there are so many characters that I think, obviously, there are going to be some that are developed more than others. And I think that some of the ones that are not developed well, it's a little nebulous, like, why they're in the book. Like, I don't know. If I'm an author thinking through how I'm going to structure a book, if I don't have the time to develop fully some characters and they're not going to play an important role in the book, like, why make them part of the puzzle? Like, why did we need eight pairs of people?
Yeah.
You know, I feel like that, like, ultimately, we have Turtle, we have, like, all of Turtle's family, the Wexlers, we have the guy, like, the guy who owns the Chinese restaurant,
what's his name?
Mr. Who. We have the athlete. Like, those are the people who end up being, like, the really main characters. And then some of the other ones just really
fall. Judge Ford is pretty big.
Judge Ford as well. Who, interesting, you know, so this is written in the 70s, and she's, like, a black judge, like, with kind of, like, big career aspirations. And one thing that I think is interesting about this book is that a number of times it doesn't make this, you know, the foregrounded issue, but there's, like, little references to the ways that there's, like, racial tensions in this tower, you know? So, like, Judge Ford is obviously really hyper-conscious about that because of her position. But there's also, like, Mr. Who's wife, Mrs. Who, is, like, just recently from China and doesn't really speak English. And it alludes to, like, people's, like, stereotyping of her when you're in, like, other characters' perspectives. I do think she's one of the characters who's not developed enough, and I wonder why she's in this book, because she barely plays a role at all. Like, you could cut, like, you go through the book and cut the parts out where she is a part, and the book would basically not change. And so I'm not sure why she's there, except just to have paired off Mr. Who. So there's
that's like, not even his partner.
Is it not?
No.
But whose partner is it?
Grace Wexler, because they end up doing.
No, sorry. I thought you meant romantic partner. I was I really thought they were married.
Partner,
oh, right.
But not his partner with the.
Yeah, so I just feel like, as short as this book is.
Something else about Judge Ford is you find out that she grew up as a child in the Westing mansion because her mom was a servant in his house. And Westing taught her how to play chess and paid for her education.
But she also hates the guy because he's so awful.
Well, and he was responsible for getting her that judge position so that she would look the other way at some of his like nefarious deals. And her partner is Mr. Westing. She just doesn't know it because her partner is Sandy in the game. Anyway.
That's one thing that I just felt like, as short as the book was, it felt like either A, it could have been longer to develop these characters, or B, probably the better option in my mind would have been like maybe scale back how many characters we have in this game. Secondly, I know you said the puzzle was creative, but like, to be honest, like, I was very confused by the puzzle, especially at the beginning. And I realize you're supposed to be confused because these characters are just given little slips of paper with like phrases on them. But like, the way that they end up solving it, they just like free associate about these words. And
I knew from the beginning that it was like after a little bit with the waves and the amber, I was like, oh, this is going to be about America the Beautiful.
Yeah, I guess. I just feel like, you know, it's like, and maybe, I mean, it's intended to be, like, complicated. So, you know, maybe this is, I mean, this is probably a me problem, but it just felt like kind of nonsense. Like, the premise of the puzzle felt like nonsense. Once they started associating the right things, like, and the ball started rolling, then you could see kind of how connections were. But, like,
the jump
from this to that, I don't know. Usually there's a clear objective in the puzzle. Like,
you just haven't been reading a lot of Louise Penny lately.
It's true. But I don't know. If I were given a slip of paper and I had to free associate these words until I got, you know, like some of the things that they go through is like, maybe these are, if you rearrange the letters in these words, they're stocks that you have to invest in. And that's,
well, that's what they think, but it's not.
Right, but I guess, well, what I'm saying
Theo
is that, like...
Theo thinks, one of the other characters thinks that it's like a chemical formula.
Mm-hmm.
Something about fertilizer. I don't remember.
Right, and like, I guess at the point where all the characters were just getting things wrong all the time, I was feeling a little bit like I was floating out into space. Well, and I'm like, what is the drive here? Like, what pieces are supposed to be put together? And granted,
that's
not...
The point was that they were supposed to work together to figure it out. Because
yeah.
They had to eventually talk to each other and put the clues together. Because the clues on their own weren't getting them anywhere.
Right. And, I mean, the part of the book I'm talking about is a fairly short part of the book. But, like, I remember they're all invited into the reading of the will, and they're like, oh, it's a puzzle. And then the puzzle is given, and I'm just like, what? And I mean, that's what the characters are saying too, but there's an early stage of that where it just feels like I, as a reader, am not being given the tools to understand like what this is, and all these characters are doing are just spitballing about it in a way that just felt adrift, like I was adrift a little bit. But then it kind of comes back together again once you start seeing some of the characters like are starting to make progress. Anyway, I mean, I liked it overall, but those were the things I would say I didn't like.
My biggest thing I didn't like was also the Mrs. Who. Do they call her Madam Who? Is that right?
That's, I don't remember.
Looking for her whole subplot. You find out that she's been stealing from everybody.
Yeah, that's strange.
And her whole character the whole time, she just seems like she's there to be a misunderstood stereotype, but.
But we're not given any depth behind
her. Right, no depth behind her. I felt really weird. I didn't really understand why she was stealing, why that was significant to the story. Like, she's just very flat in a way that, like, considering she's also Chinese, it just felt icky to me.
But it's weird because, like, the book goes out of its way to, like, kind of make the other characters look foolish because they're being bigoted toward her.
Didn't feel like it did, though. Like, I didn't feel that there was, like, judgment on them. I just felt like nobody was paying attention to her, and then she was, like, stealing their stuff and felt bad about it. But I don't know. That whole subplot I felt like was very underdone. Another one that I didn't fully understand. Okay, so Turtle's sister is Angela. Angela is this beautiful, I almost said demure, but that word is so meme-y right now, like, I can't use it. She's, like, really meek, and everyone just wants to talk about how beautiful she is. She's engaged to this doctor guy. He's an intern, Denton Deer.
He's going to be a doctor.
But he's going to be a doctor.
Denton Deer, what an amazing, like, waspy name.
Another big thing that we're not explaining is that the Westing family and the Wexler family, which is Turtle, her sister Angela, her mom Grace, and her dad Jake? Yes, Jake. Those two families are kind of like foils of each other. So if you remember, the Westings had a daughter who died when she didn't want to marry this like politician that her mom was really like pushing for her to marry. Angela is engaged to this guy that's going to be really successful, all these things. Her mom really wants that marriage. Angela doesn't want it. Angela apparently looks like Violet Westing is a big thing we find out. Anyway, when Crow is like turning herself in, Angela flips out. Like, she's like, no, no, no. But I don't have any indication that Angela has a prior relationship with this woman. And then Crow decides to give, she thinks she won the inheritance, which we later find out Turtle actually won it. Bertha Crow says, give my inheritance to Angela. And I guess the implication there is that she's like, reminds her of her daughter because she looks like her. And she, I guess this is like her penance because she lost her daughter when she was forcing her into this marriage that she doesn't want, which is just kind of like flat to me. Like this, I don't know, it just seems like a big stretch. This looks like my kid. I feel bad for what I did to my kid, so give her my money. There's no reason why Angela appears to have this relationship with her, but all of a sudden at the end, we're supposed to assume that these two people are close. So anyway, those two subplots, I was just like, kind of like, I don't know about that.
But I feel like we both have the same basic problem with the story, right, which is that there's so many parts in this very short book, and not all of the parts
are necessary
or developed enough to make them feel like they are have a point or that they make sense.
But I definitely give this book a thumbs up.
Yeah, I'll give it a thumbs up too.
I don't know if I'm interested in watching the movie.
I've heard the movie is terrible.
Oh, okay, then I'm not interested in watching it.
By I have heard, when I was looking it up online, the comments underneath said, the book is so much better, blah, 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 blah. So maybe it's not terrible.
I do think like a TV series makes sense. And I think that gives you an opportunity to flesh these characters out more. Oh, yeah,
this is like 100% like, you could make this a TV series, like flesh out people's backstories.
Absolutely.
And stuff. I could definitely imagine that. I can also imagine, and I mean, I know that these are like riffing off of the kind of novels that this is, you know, informed by as well. But those like, you know, the Rian Johnson, you know, Knives Out movies with, who's the name of that inspector?
Oh, crap.
Like, I could see that style of movie being really fun, like when set, like with this story.
I was just thinking.
But, yeah, anyway. Good book. People don't talk about it enough. Or maybe I just haven't been listening when people talk about it. But.
Benoit Blanc.
That's right. Yeah, Benoit Blanc needs to come and get to the bottom of these Westing games. All right, Rebecca, what are we reading next?
We are going to read Jacob Have I Loved, which was the 1981 winner. It was written by Katherine Patterson. Neither of us have read it, but we've both read Bridget Terabithia, which she also wrote, and I love that book.
Terabithia have I read.
Yes. Anyway, so we're going to read that. We did want to give a shout out to our most recent fan who's reached out to us that we don't know in person, Timothy King. Timothy, thank you for emailing us and for listening to us at all and being interested in what we have to say, but also giving us some like extra things to read and look into. And anyway, good feedback. One thing that Timothy suggested is that we let you guys know when we are actually talking about the book in case you want to skip our what else we're reading section. So I think we're going to start including that in the blurb, right?
Yeah, the little, like, are they called show notes? Whatever the description of the episode is, I'll put the time that our book discussion begins, and we're not rambling about War on Terror books or whatever anymore.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thanks. And hopefully the next episode will come out sooner than this one did.
It shall.
Fingers crossed.